It's really good to be here. I was here a few years ago. I can't remember exactly when, but I remember last time too, feeling like, you know, you go to a new place and it's not your place, but you feel that sense of, you know, the goodness of fellow yogis and the support of that and how beautiful it is. And then also remembering that actually there are quite a few familiar faces here, and the support of that is really lovely. So nice to see you all. I live in Hawaii now, but I'm from Holyoke, Massachusetts. So I come back and it's like very evocative, you know, especially this time of year, and how cold and rain, and it's like, oh, right, string that just like that grind, you know, back and forth. Just how hard it is, you know. And so beautiful, you know, the excitement of, and actually I've been kind of throughout, even in the month I've been in the Northeast, I've been in a bunch of different areas, and see that just the huge differences from one, you know, miles apart from each other in terms of the trees and the changes, and just, you know, reminded again of just how powerful the energy of spring is, and seeing everything kind of come back from that barrenness and that fallow time into the, you know, the decomposing leaves and trees and all the cycles of, you know, production and reproduction that are happening all around us, within us, the farmers getting back to work. And I'm 40 now. I've been surprised to see all my friends are like reproducing still, and they keep doing it, and all the animals are reproducing, and there's just that like that energy of just, you see that whether we do it genetically or biologically, it's that energy is internal too, right? Just this, that conjuring, this constant conjuring of ourselves into the future. And how beautiful it is, actually. There's so much, you know, to value in the beauty of creation and recreation in the what can be produced from the human heart, from the world outside of us, and also the exhaustion of it. You know, sometimes the pain of spring, the pain of having to come out, and the brightness, and sometimes if we feel that any protection in the seclusion of the darkness, you know, and the beauty of that, the relief of that, sometimes the long days and the external energy can just start to feel like very intense, you know. So I feel very sensitive to that right now, and so it's good to sit. It's even just today, you know, I've been very busy since I've been back, and so in this region, and just to come together and be quiet and sit, there's such a sense of relief in that, even if it's, you know, all the compost. And you know, in that, the seeing that, like, of being with newborns and the beauty of that recently, of just like how incredible and the magic of that, and also to see as they're forming, something is already so formed in beings when they come to birth. You know, there's so much that's already there that we're, you know, it's not like a clean slate, really. You know, there's like, it's amazing to see the personality and these qualities so early, you know. And one of the things I was doing, I have a great aunt who's lived in Nyack, New York for many years. And now she has, in the sort of later stages of dementia, and to see that other end of the spectrum of like just a few loops that the mind keeps going in, you know, and what can be there when so much else is gone, you know, that we've sort of gone through this creation and disillusion of self, of mind, of capacity, of the senses, and actually how humbling that is to see the reality of if we don't pay attention to what we're conjuring moment by moment, day to day, in and out, that, and we don't put effort into that investigation, that training, you know, what those loops that we end up with can be pretty painful, very bitter, wanting, you know, they can be kind of hard to see when everything else is gone, kind of what's left in the mind. And inspiring, you know, when my father passed away about 5 years ago, it was from a brain tumor. And so there was a similar process happened. And with him, it wasn't as kind of haunting in terms of what was remaining. But I could still see, I was still sensitive to just the subtle depths of these patterns that we do in terms of our little behaviors and these little unconscious things and how deep it is. And both kind of struck with that inspiration to get free, you know, to really try to see, try to understand these patterns internally for myself. And also the humility of seeing how, you know, just like how subtle a level so much of it is happening at, you know, and what actually a big task it is to try to really bear the intensity and develop the refinement of mind to really see these subtle patterns. I remember a bunch of years ago, I say that because I actually can't remember how many years ago, I don't know, the early 2000s, in Amherst, Massachusetts, there was a gathering of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and this very well beloved and revered Cambodian monk, Mahagosananda, was actually living in the area towards the end of his life. If you don't know him, he was just an amazing being, you know, very dedicated to peace and internally, but also in Cambodia, and is just an incredible peace worker there. But by the time he had moved to Amherst and was being taken care of there, he also was, you know, just really deep into Alzheimer's and essentially had like, you know, very little kind of intellectual cognitive capacity. But he was just incredible to be with, right? There was just a sense of when everything else is gone, he had actually untangled a bunch, you know, that there was just like, it was just nice to be around him. He was so pleasant and very happy and connected and enthusiastic, you know, and there was just this, to be struck with that other end of it, of like, oh, yes, we're not going to be able to control how we die and what the conditions and sort of details of that are, but that we do have some capacity in the present moment to keep being interested enough to look at what's happening, to try to understand it, and through that understanding start to untangle some of these knots around greed, hatred, delusion, these defenses against the wildness of life. And in that we can't control the inevitability of old age and death, but that we can make that a much more beautiful process. Indeed, we can make it a process that doesn't keep generating more and more self, more and more continuity, more and more anxiety that leans us into becoming in the next moment. There's a beautiful way that this process of aging, of sickness, of death, of the awareness, of course, there's, in our tradition, we have these stories of the divine messengers, you know, and how they can be such inspiring forces for us to engage in our practice and to try to get free and to do this untangling as best we can. And we'd also don't have to wait for hardship to happen. It's one of these mysteries of humanity, you know, that things often have to get super bad before we're engaged or like, we need to show up and change and do something, you know. It's, and yet, you know, that there are times where that is the only way, you know, where we have to be shocked and confronted with something very dramatic before it really, that we get that clarity of how important it is and our sense of capacity, the sense of spiritual urgency, the sense of feeling that we're capable of freedom and that deep level of kindness and transformation. One of the founding teachers of my organization, I just went out to British Columbia to help support him and my teacher in a retreat that they've been holding there for 30 years. And he had just had a stroke this winter. And it was very beautiful to see Stephen Smith, if any of you know him. Just the way that it has profoundly charged his practice, you know, that urgency, but also like with a lot of calm, a lot of care, a lot of humility, of course, that when something like that happens, that there's this charge of just like really being mindful, partly because it's a survival skill. You have to actually be so careful, right? When half of your body isn't working or you're on so many blood thinners that if you cut yourself, it's like, you know, a serious emergency. So there's like a immediacy to the motivation, but also that not living in anxiety, you know, that willingness to go through it, to help it make us more tender, more careful, more kind, more humble. It's been very beautiful to see. It's really still sitting with me. Sometimes I think we don't, in our aspirations, we have sometimes like this kind of grandiosity of what we're going to be like when we're fully enlightened, you know, and just sort of radiating or whatever. And I think about the Saito U Lakana, who was the teacher at this monastery in Upper Burma that I've helped with this retreat for the last 10 or 15 years. It's been going on for 25 years. You know, he really was in many ways a kind of great teacher, whatever that means in the sort of bigger sense. But actually the things that now that he passed away maybe 4 years ago that really sit with me most are just his commitment to just gentleness, this sense of just wanting to be kind to everyone and kind to himself and kind to people and the purity of that, of actually being with him in that way and his voice, how soft it always was and soothing. It's a helpful reminder that sometimes our aspirations can actually be quite tender and soft and subtle, and that sometimes that's where we find the deepest purity. There's a probably the most, not probably, for sure, the most free person in this way, this flavor of freedom, the Buddha's flavor of freedom, the person who I've met of the most untangled was a monk in that same area in Upper Burma. He was the abbot of a monastery right next door to where we have our retreat. Myatong Sayadaw. Some other folks had nicknamed him the Happy Sayadaw because he was just like the happiest person they'd ever met, you know, and different from a lot of the other monastics in our tradition in Burma that are much more sort of contained and energetically sort of distant. He was like that And then he would move into like incredible engagement, incredible levity and lightness and fun and kind of very playful, which I think just, it felt sort of more engaging to a certain part of our hearts that was, sometimes we need to be able to imagine ourselves free, right? And if all of the monks and nuns and don't kind of reflect anything back to us that feels familiar, sometimes that can be tricky, you know? So this, have someone who is so free and like, also lived in a certain quality of joy that was relatable, was very powerful. I remember going to him at some point. I met him when he was already quite old, in his, you know, mid-90s, and he was skin and bones and so light and, you know, looked so frail, and, you know, he has big glasses on, his robes kind of hang off of him. And I remember going to him once, and there was a lot of music outdoors, like outside of his monastery. It was like this, Michael Jackson was like blaring outside. And so, and this kind of like, a lot of times people come to that retreat, Chazo, and they think they're going to be out in the monastery, and it's often like quite noisy, you know, and there's like, you know, you're in a village, you're in a community, and there's celebration, and there's funerals, and there's weddings, and, you know, there's all kinds of things happening, and that's the, that's a part sometimes of the tradition, I think, that doesn't always come across here, right? That there is a value of seclusion, and there's a value of integration in our world, and the beauty and tension of that. And so I said, Saito, you know, does that bother you, you know, the music outside, ever? And he was like, he's like, I can't hear anything. He's like, I can barely see, I can't hear. He's like, ah, ha, 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 you know? I love it. He's like, it's no problem. He's like, so joyous in the, like, declining of the senses, right? The sort of, like, getting old and just, like, you know, the it was so beautiful. Michelle has a story of, she went to him at some point and asked him about his practice life, and he talked about how for many, 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 many years he would do these four recollections, and one of them is this, just the recollection of death and the sort of meditation on death, and, you know, for years you just imagine this, you know, his the way he practiced was these phrases: everyone I know will die, and I too will die. Everyone I know will die, and I too will die. And he, you know, he really kind of gave that, like, the, that quality of, like, the soberness and the truth of that, and then the relief of being okay with the truth of that. And he said, and you know what? When I die, I'm not going to be surprised. Ah! You know, it was like, right, yes. And then, a few years ago, he died. And it was a year I didn't go. And so, in the ensuing years, it's been just, you know, powerful to kind of go up to, there's a pagoda that they built, in kind of in his honor, up on the hill above their monastery, and just to really just reflect on what I feel like I've received from him, and the beauty of that, and the purity of it, and the energetics are just so different of someone who's quite liberated in that way. That's not what I always expect. It's like, it felt like being, I could only think is like, it felt like the being next to the opposite of a nuclear reactor, right? It was just such this sort of relief in it. And it was, you know, so I would go and hang out at his place, because some of that, I'm not a super kind of vibe person, but there was something in that that still felt accessible and beautiful to kind of reconnect with. And then this year, when I was up at his pagoda, the new abbot of his monastery was up there, who we know, and he's been there for as long as I've known. And so I was just sitting, and there was a couple of us up there, and he said, oh, come on over. He's like, do you want to see Saito? And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, oh, well, we opened the crypt. Is that the right, quite right word? And we had not quite known what had happened with his body. It was sort of one of these things of like, oh, did he get cremated? You know, that's often something that happens, you know, and they'll look for relics. And there's a lot of energy put into kind of trying to find evidence of someone's enlightenment. And we just sort of never knew and didn't really ask. Well, he opens this door, and it turns out that there is a glass coffin where Sayadaw has been for 4 years. And so there was his corpse, having decomposed to the degree that it did during that time. There was, of course, a lot of bone, but also, you know, flesh and his robes and his glasses and, you know, powerful smells and moisture and bugs inside. It was quite amazing. I have never seen a human body that far decomposed. And of course it's part of our tradition, right? Part of some of the Satipatthana Sutta and several suttas, you know, the Buddha talks about going to the charnel grounds and observing and having these reflections of, you know, that this body is not other than that. I am not different than that. This will happen to me as well. There's no avoiding this. And just the beauty of that teaching, of this sense of his lack of fear of decomposition, didn't change. It had been there, right? The sense of he was not at war with nature, with the reality of mind and body. And there was such a relief of that in his lifetime to be around that, to kind of be reflected with that. And then this just powerful teaching, whatever his intention was around it, around this choice, you know, 4 years after he's died, to just not have bells and whistles, not try to be showing a magic trick, not trying to be anything special, but actually to allow this degree of disintegration, of disillusion, of falling apart, of surrender to nature, was just very powerful for me and my friends who I was with. And it brings up, amongst other things, just this, you know, the ways, of course, in our lives that we fight against that. And that, you know, he was the first person to show the merit of giving medicine and taking care of ourselves and loving these bodies and loving these minds and attending to them responsibly. And yet not having that anxiety about life and death, not having that clinging, not having that need for becoming. And of course that there's like the physical aspect of that, but there's the mental aspect of that. There's the emotional piece, the way that the mind-heart is also so often so powerfully invested in what's next, right? This the next moment. Never mind the future in a sort of more abstract way. It's a little bit what we're sort of trying to get to in our instructions in the sitting here this evening of like, can we be really humble and honest about the way we see our minds just inclining into the future, this sort of intrusion of hope onto what's next? Are we getting concentrated? Are we getting mindful? Are we getting insight? You know, on one hand, of course, those are rooted in some beautiful motivations. And on the other hand, they are also investing ourselves into the next moment, right? They're reifying ourselves. There's this process of bhava, of becoming, and the insistence on it, the clinging to it, the fixedness on it, the anxiety around who are we? Who are we trying to create? What is this next moment going to be? And just that, how powerful it is. How are we willing to sort of see that? Are we willing to bear the intensity of that pain, of that leaning into the next moment? What is it like to explore that settling back? That just that receiving of sense sensations? Where does it feel safe to do that? Where is the mind trained enough to just be with what's happening? And then where does it feel the need that is not safe? That actually the present moment is actually too unstable, too undependable, too out of our control to feel settled in. And so that it leans into the future to try to solidify, create, define, substantiate, and control. And to have that level of interest and like appreciation of really getting it, it's only because the mind isn't trained enough, right? It's to really understand that all of the things that we think we're trying to undo, the greed, the hatred, the delusion, the ignorance, to really understand that these are our defenses against this just flood of fabrication that is out of our control. Right, we are at. I like to joke about, like, you know, there's like a lot of out there of like, oh, just be in the present moment, and the present moment is like liberating, and the present moment is so great, and you'll be healed, and it's like, it's obviously ridiculous, you know. The present moment is horrible, you know. It's this just like unrelenting stream of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience at every sense door. And it's like, no, of course we're running from it, you know? It's like, oh my God, you know? And so it's like, yes, we're trying to solidify ourselves. We're trying to like put out the bad and cling on to the good and tune out what's like out of our control, you know? That's not crazy. You know, that's totally understandable. If the mindfulness and concentration and you know, all the seven factors and everything, if those aren't there, that the mind has to protect itself one way or another. And the way it's learned to do it is by running, by clinging, by tuning out. And we have to have like some appreciation that that defense mechanism has probably saved us, right? In this lifetime, probably many times. Never mind in the past. Never mind when we were raccoons or gorillas or whatever, you know, little amoebas, you know, that sense of like, you run from what's trying to get you. You try to get what you think is going to save you. And you can't deal with a bunch of stuff, right? And like, and to really appreciate that those contractions of the heart mind are entirely understandable. And of course, they're suffering and they lead to more suffering. And that the constant conjuring ourselves is exhausting. We seek a freedom beyond conditions. But we understand that the heart just isn't trained yet to do that. And so that's all we're doing, is this willingness to see that and to try to build up the capacity to be with what's happening right now. And we can be with the whole flood. We can try to focus on just sort of one part of it. But to get that, it's a lot. You know, it's a lot just being with the rising and falling of the breath, right? I mean, that's so hard. Never mind all of the flood of mind and body and sound and sight and, you know, all of our history and all that gets evoked in that. And so, you know, we have to give ourselves a little bit of a break, a little bit of compassion, a little bit of permission to think, right? A little bit of permission to be defensive, for anger to arise, for wanting to arise, to not kind of smack ourselves on the wrist because we think it's bad. We have to get that it's the mind heart doesn't feel safe in the constant flux of reality, the rising and passing, the creation and destruction, the lack of coherence is quite threatening. And yet there still needs to be some aspiration, right? Some wanting to be free of that, some place where we actually don't want to have to fall back on these underlying trainings of the heart, that we do want to be able to have that freedom beyond conditions. There's a great sutta about Daniya, the cattleman, and it's just sort of different. There's something kind of beautiful about it. It's complicated, as many are, but the baseline is that you have Daniya, who has in his life managed to become a wealthy rancher, and he has his house together, and he has his big family, and he has his cows, and he feels like he's sort of figured it out and kind of established himself and feels the security in that. And then across the river, you have the Buddha, who has nothing, right? Who's given up everything, who has no home, who has no family, who has no possessions. And he's kind of exclaiming the beauty of his security. And you have this sort of poem that goes back and forth that's quite beautiful. I'll just read the first couple of stanzas. So Daniya sings out, "The rice is cooked, the milking done. I live with my people along the banks of the Mahi River. My hut is roofed, my fire is lit. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain." And the Buddha calls out, "Free from anger, my stubbornness gone. I live for one night along the banks of the Mahi River. My hut's roof is open. My fire is extinguished. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain." And one of the beautiful things about that, this back and forth that happens, is the Buddha isn't judging Daniya for his sense of security or what he's done to try to establish that. But he is showing that ultimately that isn't that deep a security, right? So many things could go wrong. So many anxieties can keep someone in that condition from sleeping well. There's another sutta where he talks about people who have like all of this comfort, but are worried about its loss or inflamed by wanting more, that they don't sleep well. And that though he sleeps in the cold, windy, barren, open space, that he in the world is one who sleeps well. And this sort of ease of mind of not having acquisitions, not having having come to that sense of unconditional peace, right? It's very beautiful. And so in the end, you know, it's not like Daniya still stays Daniya. He doesn't become a monk and leave his family. And, you know, it's like he honors what the Buddha is saying, and you know, that he and his family and wife in particular, they become disciples, and, you know, they recognize the truth of this deeper freedom. And so the sense of course, there's the monastic and the lay and all of that, but that ultimately the Buddha recognized our powerful tendency to kind of create a structure internally as much as externally that tries to protect us, that tries to create some sense of sort of solidity and containment in the uncontrollable. And while there can be beautiful things that are inspired by that and are the result of that, that there is also this willingness to break it down, to decompose, to allow the self to fall apart. In this, you know, classic refrain, when he gets enlightened himself, he speaks out in verse. "O house builder, you are seen. You shall not build this house again. Your rafters have been broken up. Your ridge pole is demolished. My mind has attained the unconstructed Nibbana and reach the end of any sort of craving." And so, you know, there is a... None of us would be here if we weren't seekers, right? None of us would do the practice if we didn't have a longing for this kind of peace, this kind of freedom. And yet we have to also see in our practice that there are times where that seeking, that longing, is also part of the mechanism that's reestablishing ourselves in the next moment, right? That's like becoming is still coming out of that same energy around like what's next and what do we want and who are we going to be and what are we going to get? And this willingness, it's like where do we find that, that call to peace, the call to letting it go, to letting the body decompose, letting the mind decompose, and willing to see the pain of that constant urge towards construction, towards building this house internally, externally, and the beauty of it at times, but also the painfulness of it, and to see that that constant self-assertion, that constant contraction around reality as part of something that we actually long to be free of. Of course, it means going through it. It means being willing to see it more and more clearly. It's not, again, just a kind of like behavior modification. It's like we have to see it. We have to be willing to bear the intensity and the pain that it's coming from, to see the vulnerability, right? There's one way of translating dukkha just as vulnerability. And to really understand that it's not like we need to become more vulnerable. I mean, there's something to that language that's, that can be helpful, but to also understand that vulnerability is the nature of things, the nature of being, and that it is actually very hard to abide in this constant arising and passing of phenomena. So we have to, on one hand, develop a taste for that flavor of freedom, right? Develop a taste for that particular quality of release and relief that might not always come naturally. It might not always be what we think of as our deepest motivation, but that it's very important to also see that, like, we're not just trying to become better yogis. We're not trying to be just better parents or better children or better partners or better, you know, there's a way in which it's like, of course, that's, some of these tools of the practice can help us be kinder, more understanding, more sympathetic, more patient with other people. But to be careful about, it's like that we're, that through our practice, we can actually be strengthening becoming. And as much as like we're afraid of death and afraid of the end of our lives, it's like we shouldn't be afraid of death. We should be afraid of becoming. That it's this urgency to reassert ourselves that actually is so painful, to be somebody, to be nobody, to whatever, you know, this like, that is the mechanism of our suffering, the mechanism of our continued imprisonment. And to be sensitive to that, to be sensitive to this part of the process of this reassertion of ourselves moment to moment, to have patience with it, to have kindness with it, to understand that it takes so much of those two things, along with the courage, right? The willingness to keep showing up for it, to keep seeing it, to keep bearing the intensity in our hearts of wanting, of not wanting, of tuning out. And that willingness to keep going through, the courage and the kindness and the patience. And that sort of just appreciation of the process. Appreciation of these tools, of these teachings, of this tradition, you know, just where would we be without them? You know, I think that, that piece of just really honoring through all of the, you know, you can like think about how great the tradition is. And of course, you know, it's all full of humans and it's been humans the whole time. And that's never easy, you know it's been hard, you know it's been complicated, you know there's been things left out, you know that, you know, we don't have the full picture, of course, of what the Buddha really said, of what happened to the nuns, and, you know, I mean, there's like so much that we know that we've inherited that is the result of lots of human folly and hardship and error, and yet how beautiful that this has still come through these thousands of years, that we still have access to these teachings and these traditions, and that we have fellow journeyers, you know, the sense of community, of sangha, of just really getting how important that is. There is this truth of our own independent responsibility, ultimately, for our own disentanglement. And yet, we just can't do it alone. It's just too hard. It's actually too hard. And the power of, you know, one spiritual friend, I've been liking, Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated the word Sampavanka as comrade. And I know it doesn't have the same connotation probably 2,600 years ago as it does now, but I like that. I like that sort of spark of that. That, of course, Kalyanamita is beautiful in terms of spiritual friend, but Sampavanka, the comrades along this journey that have this courage and have this strength and have this tenderness of shared experience. I think about the friends who I was with when I saw Sayadaw's body, and I just know that the power of that transmission, the power of that experience was better integrated for me because I had the love of friends, right? The love of comrades with me who it also impacted, who wordlessly or with words we could share the intensity of that. It's why, whether it's love that's relational with other people or simply our metta practice, our compassion practice, our mudita practice, our equanimity, understanding that if we don't have the buoyancy of care for self, care for others, care for the world, care for each moment of sense experience that's arising and passing, that that's the only thing that keeps the mind and heart buoyant enough to be able to actually bear the intensity of reality, right? To actually bear the truth of things, that things are constantly unchanging, totally undependable, incoherent. These three truths are sobering. And of course, you know, sometimes we're there with it, and sometimes we're amazed by it, and sometimes that peace of the freedom and the relief of not fighting that and just being with the relentless tides of coming and going of the mind and body, it's so beautiful. And then, you know, when it's not there, we need to be very careful about where we're forcing the heart, where we're forcing the body, the mind, and where do we have that sense of tenderness, of compassion, of understanding our limits, understanding that the heart, mind need protection, need buoyancy, need that warmth of our caring, and that one another need it as well, right? That we're all in trying our best, as humbling and disappointing as that can be, you know, to kind of keep our heads above water and to try to be good stewards of these bodies, these minds, of the world that we live in. Where do we have that sense of rigor and of compassion for ourselves and for one another? Maybe I'll just end with some words that the different phrases that the Buddha used in different places to describe the mind in turmoil and the mind that's released. It's just a way of kind of coming back into that sense of the quality of the liberated mind and how beautiful it is to get a taste of that and be drawn more and more in that direction. So for the mind we often find ourselves in, he talks about, you know, that delight, people that delight in their fetters, delight in their chains, that beings are afflicted by form, clinging to the world, stuck on taking up, craving for sense pleasure, entangled in a tangle, oppressed by birth and old age, shrouded by old age and death. Attached to existence, they yearn, hanker, and lust for being. They are bound in perplexity. And then for the disentangled mind that is untarnished, untroubled, fumeless, wishless, dust-free, gone beyond all phenomena, purified by equanimity and mindfulness, emancipated, abandoned craving, dispelled evil, devoid of greed, cross the flood, wise, owning nothing, taking nothing, quenched, crossed over perplexity, supported by nothingness, seen renunciation as security. Just sit for a minute with those evokings in mind and heart and body.